Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Second Chance Podcast. I'm Raphael Rowe, your host. This podcast series explores the theme of second chance. We raise questions about who deserves a second chance, who decides who gets a second chance, and what a second chance actually means. We speak to people from all walks of life about their experiences, including those who have been given a second chance and some who you might believe are beyond deserving a second chance. Before I introduce my guest today, I wanted to ask you to support the Raphael Rowe Foundation. The mission of the foundation is to end dehumanization of people in prison and build safer societies. We work with those who administer prison systems throughout the world and inspire them to abolish dehumanizing, degrading, and dangerous practices, putting more emphasis on the health, education, and rehabilitation of those in their care. In many prisons across the world, basic human rights are not being met and systems are collapsing, causing overcrowding, rising violence, suicides, and drug issues, making it difficult to rehabilitate inmates and reintegration back into society. I know this because if any of you have watched my Netflix series, Inside the World's Toughest Prisons, you would have seen what I'm talking about. If you want to help, please visit the website at www.raphaelrowefoundation.org and register your support for the work we're doing. And if you can afford to make a donation to help our mission, please click on the donate link on the website, which will take you to our GoFundMe campaign. Thank you. Now, my guest today is Matthew Ullman, a talented musician from Barbados, who I first came across when I was sent a demo of his singing two songs about me. For the first time, Matthew talks about his mental breakdown and being diagnosed with bipolar disorder. People with bipolar experience both episodes of severe depression and mania. The experience of bipolar is uniquely personal, and it's said that no two people have exactly the same experience. For Matthew, it led to him being institutionalized in an asylum in Barbados, where he was kept in isolation and medicated. Matt, thanks for coming in and joining me today.
Thank you for having me around.
I know that you did some songs for me, actually. So that's the first thing I want to talk about, you know. Raphael.
Yeah, Raphael Road.
Man, that was
wicked.
You
don't know what he has been through.
Unbelievable, man. You did two of them for me.
Yeah.
And I do appreciate that. And for those who are listening, how did that come about, Matt? Because you did these two songs, having learnt about my experience of being a wrongly convicted prisoner. And you were approached by a very talented guy called Amit, who asked you to put something together, Amit. And you did.
I met Amit in Zara, and he just exuded this presence of, no, you're here. Almost. It's like, because he just has this ability to get people sucked into his world of film and podcasts and stuff. And he asked me to work on your song because he was doing your documentary. We thought, hey, Matthew, you're a good singer. I got this idea. I want to take a song, one of these really cool songs from the 90s, and throw it on top of his podcast as an introduction, one of these introductory themes. So I said, all right, fair enough. I'll have a listen. Listen to the song. It was No, No, No by Don Penn, right? Song I always liked. And then I watched your interview. And I was so moved by everything that you went through. And to some extent, I tried to almost imagine myself in your shoes because I've had my own small stint of being incarcerated, but in a different scenario. So I tried to use a bit of that with what you've gone through and your story and how hard it was for you and your mental issues and just the problems that come with somebody who comes out of prison, someone who has been in prison and had been in prison for a reason that they had nothing to do with. You know, they just, they made a mistake, and or in your situation, you didn't even make a mistake, but you, this is where my mind gets all clouded. This is where my...
How did Amit know that you had this talent for singing? Were you there in Zara singing?
You know what's funny? Okay. You know what's funny? Amit told me he saw me performing in the road because I was, I used to perform from time to time at bars and stuff like that. Basically, just when I got here to England, I wanted to get my performances going. I'm a singer, songwriter. I wanted to get far into the music industry. So I decided, hey, things are a bit difficult. Told my wife, I'm going to go and start busking because I wasn't getting the gigs I wanted at the time. My wife was a big fan of it, but she said, go ahead. So I live in Slough. I decided I'm going to go and busk on Pescott Street. Once I got to Pescott Street, started busking, started getting in the vibe and getting people going. At some point, the Prince of Windsor, Amit, passes me, and I guess he spots me. And he's a guy who knows how to spot talent, right? And that's what he always says. I don't think that, you know, I'm the biggest talent, but I get where he's coming from. Mm. So he spots me. And I guess it clocked in his mind, hey, this is a good guy. So then we met in Zara just by chance. I was in Zara just getting some threads, and he happened to see me, talk to me about my singing. And then he also introduced me to your situation with your documentary and your life and what you've been through. And I found it so intriguing that I decided to write the song.
And that led to Raphael.
Raphael Rowe. It's a bit hard to fit it in, right? But
well, you did a fantastic
thank
job.
You. It's a bit funny to fit in.
I'm going to steer my listeners to listen to it. You mentioned that you came to the UK. Where did you? I mean, I can detect you have an accent, but you tell me, where are you from and why did you end up coming to the UK from wherever it is you're from?
Well, a lot of people think that I'm from the US, but I'm from Barbados, that tiny little country in the Caribbean.
You forgot beautiful, tiny little country.
Well, it is a beautiful... Oh, yeah, no, that goes without saying, right? But it is a tiny little country. Beautiful beaches, beautiful people here represented. But that's where I'm originally from, Barbados. I went to school at Combermere School. If anybody knows a bit about Combermere School, they'll also know that Rihanna went to Combermere School. So I was a year above her. So fun little fact, when Rihanna was training for a pageant that we have at school every summer. And at that pageant, she wanted to sing a song. And I kind of helped her with the singing of the song. And then she performed that song at the pageant, and that was a pageant where I think a guy called Evan Rogers, I may be wrong on this, but I think Evan Rogers was there, and he was the guy who signed Robin Rihanna Fenty to Def, I think, is it Def Jam? Yeah. Jay-Z's records.
Wow.
So I don't think she'll ever, I don't think she'll ever admit it. I'll just tell you that. No, I don't think she'll ever admit it. But to be fair, I remember this 100%. She was in, we were in the, what do you call that? The auditorium. Mm-hmm. And she was singing this song. And I could sing as well, but I wasn't really that good at that time. And she was pretty good as well. But I was helping her just from the little understanding I had from singing, growing up in the church and you know, doing performances at the Salvation Army. Because that's the church I grew up in. And, you know, my sisters also, they used to sing. One of my sisters also went to Common Mirror. And she used to perform with a group of girls. At that time when girl groups and boy groups were like a thing. That was around the time of like Boys to Men, TLC.
You mentioned that you didn't recognize your own abilities or talents then, yeah. Whereas Rihanna was spotted and she's gone on to be the biggest, richest, and all the things that have come from that. And you must take credit wherever you can.
I got a snippet wherever.
Where did it lead to for you then? Where did that moment lead to you? School and life in Barbados.
Well, I decided that I wanted to do singing full time. I wanted to become a performer. I wanted to get into the music industry. So I had some friends. They had this group called Azman. A-Z-M-A-N. Azman. And between myself and these guys, they would do this thing called fling. It is the Bajan version of rapping. So it's like rapping, but in a Barbadian accent. Like, goblin, I don't know, I done it, did. Like that, right? And it was doing well. And I would sing on top of their tracks. But unfortunately, Azman didn't, even though the guys, they got everything to a point. In Barbados, because it's so small, if you don't have the big audience to keep you going, you fall off. Right. And I think that's what happened with them. They had a bit of an audience going. I was singing with them and they fell off. So because of that, I still wanted to keep performing. So I got into a band. So I had this band called DQ. It was my first band I was in. I was the lead singer. My sister was also in the band because I wasn't fully confident in my voice yet. So I got her to also sing with me. And that's where I really started to expand more on my musical understanding and develop my musical talent, basically.
Where did that lead to? Where did you end up? Because you talked about leaving Barbados at some point and coming to the UK and busking where you met the Prince of Windsor, etc.
Yeah, no.
Why did you leave Barbados to come to the UK?
I left Barbados because I got married to my wife, who I met at a gig in Barbados. She came from England. We met at one of my gigs, a place called Santee in Barbados. It's no longer called Santee. But it was a place that I would perform every Sunday. And, you know, things between me and her got really close and we flew out. But before all of that happened, when I got into my band, the band did well. And then it did well for a while. And then again, if you don't have the popularity, if you don't have people behind you, you break down. And that's one of the major problems that I find in a small country. If you don't blow up massively, or if you're not blowing up massively in the style of music that is popular in the country, you don't get very far.
Right.
So that's what happened with my other band, DQ. So then I started singing by myself. And then I was singing with a small little band called 1359. It was myself and a guy called Chris Goodridge. And we just did this like acoustic covers number where we would just sing cover songs to hotels and restaurants. And eventually that's where I met my wife, through that avenue. And that's how I ended up getting to England and meeting Amit and now meeting you.
it's not always been plain sailing, even though you've had your struggles with the success of being the talent that you are in singing.
Mm.
Tell me about the rougher roads that you've been down, because, you know, now you are a stronger person, but I know you've had some mental health issues. Tell me about where that started and what triggered that.
Well, it is definitely a rougher road that I think a lot of men don't really like to talk about. They don't want to explore it. And in a Caribbean culture, a Black Caribbean culture, there is a heavy negative stereotype with mental health, because you're considered, you know, the village nut. So, you know, if something goes wrong. And unfortunately for me, I fully snapped. So how that came about, in 2016, that's when I met my wife. And at that point in time, just before I met her, I was going through quite a difficult period in my life. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I wasn't really sure what my direction in life was going to be. I ended up meeting my wife, Jo.
How old was you at this time?
I was 28, going 29. Yeah. Met my wife, Jo. But during this time, I thought that I should start to, if I didn't know where I wanted to go in life, look inward. So I got very heavy into meditation and into understanding the self, understanding one's ego, understanding your place in the universe almost, because I felt a bit lost. I didn't know, because everything I tried to do when it came to music all seemed to just fall away. And it becomes quite depressing when you're constantly in a situation where you feel as though you're getting somewhere, and every time you get to a point, it just falls away. So with that kind of depressed mood in mind, I wanted to lift myself out of it. So I started to get I started to listen to videos and recordings from people like Alan Watts, a gentleman by the name of Muji. Some people might know Eckhart Tolle. Mm-hmm. He's another very well-known spiritual leader, in a sense, or spiritual guider. And I was also smoking a lot of weed at that point. So I was using the weed to help relax myself, and I was getting very heavy into the spiritual and understanding of myself. And it caused a lot of feelings that I didn't know how to deal with to come up within inside me. And I'm not sure what happened, but I just snapped. There was I'll tell you this. There was a scenario in which I was sat at home. I think this is what really sent me. I wanted to stop smoking. I felt like, okay, Matthew, you're in a situation now. You're starting to understand yourself. You're starting to understand your place in the world, because you've been doing meditations. You've been trying to understand that, you know, the mind and the body they seem like two separate things, but they're really just one connected. And I was just going through all of these different, at that time, ideas in my head about what I thought being a human being was, because I was lost. I felt very lost. And I said, I need to snap the addiction I have. So I remember doing this thing. It might seem really weird, but I started to imitate smoking.
So you didn't have a spliff?
I didn't have a spliff in my hand, but I was just thinking about these affirmations. And the weird thing that happened is I started to become high when I wasn't smoking. I think that could have been a trigger for what was then diagnosed as bipolar. And I didn't know. And the problem with bipolar is when you start to get a high off of a bipolar episode, your brain starts to, let me see if I can put this in another way. Imagine if I looked at your book in a bipolar moment I'd see Raphael Rowe, Notorious. And then I would recognize there's not, and then there's I.
Right.
And then I'd be like, so why is he not and the I highlighted? And then my brain would start to analyze that and tell me something about that. And then I believe that that is true. And as you, if you have a brain that always tells you that any time you think of something, however you think about it, must be true, it can be an extremely liberating and an extremely frightening experience all at the same time.
Depending on what that truth is.
Depending on what that truth is. Because if your truth is that not I is really it's a hidden meaning of what Raphael is really trying to say. So when I look at your book and I say, Raphael Rowe, Notorious, but it says not I, it means he's not notorious, but his situation was notorious, right? That may actually be true. But then I think that any time I analyze anything like that, that is exactly what it is. And where it gets scary is when your brain then says, this is what the world has been trying to tell you, but you never noticed. I don't know if you can understand that kind of thinking.
Kind of, but how did it manifest for you to the point where it, as you say, broke you to the point where what, you needed
help? You can't trust anything you think.
But is this because, Matthew, you hadn't been diagnosed with bipolar?
Never diagnosed, but I found out later on that my family had a history, on my dad's side, he had a history, well, his mum had a mental condition, and he himself had a bit of a break, but he never spoke about it.
Right.
I only found this out when I got thrown into our... Sometimes I don't even really like talking about it, because the place that you are housed in, at the psychiatric hospital, it's not a welcoming place in Barbados.
And is that because, as you said, the stigma of having a mental health...
Yes, but not only just the stigma, the building that you were housed in, I think... used to house, I think it was attached to a great house. So I think, and I could be completely wrong, but I need to get my history a bit better on this. But what the Barbadian government did, they took a place that was a great house that had all of these like stables and like holding areas and turned it into the mental hospital.
Right.
But if you can imagine, I don't know if you've ever heard or understood the concept of things having memory. When you're speaking about mysticism, that's the best way I can put it. Mm. Some of the teachings state that every object has a memory. Like your face is a memory of your mummy or dad.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Yeah.
You understand?
It's a biological memory.
Memory. So this chair is kind of like a memory of what the first chair was. Yeah. But it's just all different reproductions of this particular thing. So if you're in a place that the memory is, it was built around slave time, possibly housing indentured servants or slaves or people who've been oppressed, and then you're now in this place as a and this is supposed to help with your mental faculties, and then you find out that this place used to be a place that housed possibly slaves or prisoners or whatever, it can really mess with you.
Can you remember, do you feel comfortable sharing what happened for you to be taken into that institution?
Yeah, that's right. So there was one day where, and I want to get my memory about it, because since then, and you can recognize I have a bit of difficulty speaking about this, and just speaking generally. Since having this mental break, I have found that my thoughts are a little harder to articulate. So you will find that as I speak, it may be a bit difficult for me to articulate my thoughts. But the real massive big breaking point, because there were several moments, because when you're bipolar, you have your ups and your downs.
Sure.
Your ups and your downs.
Sure.
But the major up and major down was I was by some of my friends a night, and we were sat watching Batman versus Superman. And for some reason, in this moment, I thought everything that was happening on the screen was what was happening to my body. Don't ask me why, but my mind told me everything that's happening on the screen is a representation of what is happening in your body right now. And it absolutely freaked me out. Because imagine, you're watching Superman and Batman fight this monster. What was his name? Doomsday. And you're thinking, Doomsday is everything that is wrong in my body. And Superman and Batman are all of my antibodies fighting this thing off. I have no idea why my brain would have said that. But this is what my brain was telling me. So I got so paranoid and so freaked out. I got in my car. I left by my friends and I flew home. I was wearing a chain similar to this with this OM sign. And I can speak to you a bit about this later on. But as I was driving home, I felt as though the chain that I was wearing got heavier and heavier. I pulled the chain off and threw it out of the window as I was driving. I got home, took all of my clothes off. This I can remember this vividly. Took all my clothes off, went and lay down in bed. Put my hands on my chest, similar to somebody who's in a coffin, and said, "If I'm gonna die, just let me die now. Please, just let me die. Just let me die. Just let me die. Just let me die." Because my brain at that moment was telling me, this may be a good place and a good time for you to experience what life is fully about. But in order for you to fully experience it, you must die. It is such a disturbing, yet almost beautiful acceptance at that moment.
There's lots of people have those thoughts. What happened to you at that moment? Did you attempt to take your own life?
No, I didn't. I said, and I've always made this a thing in my in since I was young, I'm not going to ever take my life. Mm. I'm going to let life take my life.
Right.
So in that moment, I had my hands down and I was just saying, okay, I'm just going to allow life to take my life. I'm going to allow life to take my life, take my life, take my life, take my life. My wife, she was by a bar doing a quiz at the time. She wasn't able to get in contact with me. She panicked, got one of her friends to drop her back to where we were staying, which is where I was. She came home, saw my clothes basically in the road, freaked out, ran inside and saw me basically in bed rocking, saying, "I'm going to die, I'm going to die, I'm going to die." The beautiful soul that she is, Jo, she just came, she sat down, she held me, she started to talk to me, she started to explain, "Matthew, you know what, just calm down, just calm down, just calm down." And she worked me through it. She ended up laying in bed next to me and we went to sleep. And then I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning, looked at her and I thought she was dead. I thought I was alive and everything was dead around me. Having a bipolar episode is one of the scariest things that will ever happen to a human being if they ever experience it. When I'm going through this, I think my wife is dead. I call my dad, somebody who I've had mixed feelings about from since I was young. Because, you know, I never really felt he was around, because he wasn't. Mm. I never had a good, structured relationship with him. You know, I didn't understand what it was like to be a man's man, in a sense. Because my role models, one was my dad, one was my uncle. And my uncle, even though he was a man's man, he never represented it in the way that I thought was the best way that you could. So that's a different story. But I called my dad, told him what was going on. He tells me, "Come and let to see him." I don't know if that's a good thing because I'm tripping. I get in a car. I drive to my dad. I meet my dad in a gas station. I kid you not. My dad asked me, okay, Matthew, is everything all right? What's happening? I said, Dad, I'm hallucinating. Because at this point, I'm actually hallucinating. I'm hallucinating. He says, okay, Matthew, go inside, buy a Coke, a bottle of Coke, and then come back to your car. I go inside, I buy a bottle of Coke. I look at the cashier. The cashier looks like, she looks like a person who is, she looks like a zombie. That's the best way I can put it. She looks like a zombie to me. My mind is gone. And I'm just telling myself, Matthew, try to hold yourself together because you know you've lost your mind. It's a very weird thing when you know that you've lost your mind and you can't do anything about it. Mm. You just know you've lost your mind. So I picked Coke up, went back to the car, spoke to my dad, explained to him what was happening. We started to drive around the area of where the gas station was, which was in a place called Warrens in Barbados. So there are a lot of highways. So you could, I just pulled out, went onto the highway, and he was driving around. I was in his car driving around. We pulled back into the gas station. He opened up a, and this always sticks in my mind. He opens up a briefcase, tells me, put my hand in it. I put my hand in this briefcase. He tells me, don't look. I don't look. I put my hand in the briefcase. All of my hallucinations stop. It is the weirdest thing. All of my hallucinations stop for that single moment. And now I'm thinking, okay, my dad is probably the next coming of Jesus at this point. Mm. You understand? Yeah. I am there. Mm. I am. So my mind is like, Matthew, you see, this is what I couldn't show you, because if I showed you it, you would think that you're mad. You would think that your mind is gone. So because all of this has happened, I'm totally into it. I'm totally into anything he says. Anything my mind thinks, I'm sold. Because it seems as though my father understands what's going on, but no one else does. So we speak a little more. He tells me to go home, relax myself. Try to get you know, try to just relax and things should calm down. I go back home absolutely ecstatic because I'm no longer hallucinating. Everybody looks normal. Everything's fine. And that is the moment, I think, where you get the highest peak off of your bipolar episode. Mm. I was in such a high peak. I basically went, I drove back home. My wife didn't even know I left. I drove back home, went outside, screamed out, I am Jesus Christ. The rain started to fall as soon as I said it. I know it sounds mad. It sounds ridiculous. Yeah. The rain starts to fall and I start screaming because I actually think that I've just become enlightened. Mm-hmm. For the rest of that day, I was just looping. Anything that happened, I can go into such a long discussion about it. We'll be here all day. So basically, after my massive break where I ended up going by, seeing my father and this whole scenario with the briefcase, my wife decided, hey, Matthew, I think, you know, best bet, let's just go and have you assessed at the psychiatric hospital known in Barbados as Black Rock.
Right. That was the name of the institution.
Black Rock. Because the area that it's in is called Black Rock. Okay. And the institution is known as Black Rock Psychiatric Hospital. And what I will say is when I got there, still out of my mind, and seeing other people who are not fully functioning, you assume that these people probably just went through the same thing you've gone through and they know what's going on, but the society doesn't understand it. So the society's decided to house all these people to almost restrict them from telling the world the truth. You can understand how my truth at that time. Yeah. So my mind is cycling on some different stuff. After, because I first got assessed, they said that I had a bipolar episode.
Is this the first time that this is someone the first time, told you?
This is the first time I've even heard that there was such a thing as bipolar. I didn't even know about bipolar until I was told this. I heard about schizophrenia, but I didn't know what bipolar was. I didn't know that there was such a thing, you know, that you can go up, have highs and lows and all of this kind of stuff. So being exposed to that, you know, it was obviously a bit jarring. But in my mental state, I'm thinking, I'm right. Everybody else has actually lost the plot and they don't know what's going on. But I knew that I'm in a society, and even though I was a bit off my rock, I also understood that the society I am in, I can't just think that I can just walk around and operate like this. So I allowed myself to be assessed. I didn't fight it. You know, there are some people who go through a bipolar episode who fight with people because they think that they're right and the people who are trying to help them are trying to stop it.
Okay.
Right? That's how you feel. But I said, you know what? I know I can't behave like this because this is Barbados. And Barbados is, we're not as gentle. We're gentle, but we're not as gentle as, say, England or, you know, the Western countries when it comes to understanding mental illness.
Are you saying that they'd rather hide the issue?
They're a bit more, put them, you know, house them, drug them up, hope that it sorts itself out. If it doesn't, you just keep them on drugs.
Right.
And you keep, and it's a bit of a cyclic process. And I'll get into that. But basically, I got diagnosed with a bipolar episode, was put on olanzapine, yeah, and sodium valproate and something else. Three very powerful psychiatric drugs. And at that point, I went home with my family. I didn't go with who would be my wife at the time.
How long was you in the institution?
At that time, when I first got assessed, they didn't even have space to keep me. So I had to go home, and then I would go to a psychiatric doctor every other day and check in as an outpatient to see how my meds were doing.
Right.
So
did they help the medication?
The medication, and this is the thing, this is where maybe the concept of second chance comes in. I had to allow myself to be helped. And I think that's one of the most important things when it comes to giving yourself a second chance. A lot of people ask for second chances, but you have to be willing to take it and willing to recognize that this is the second chance coming. My mind was gone and I wanted to get it back. So when I first started taking my medication and first recognizing, okay, this is the opportunity for me to get my head level, I hated taking medication. Because what would happen is that you would feel dull. Medication would kill every emotion you had. So instead of feeling excited or feeling super depressed or freaked out, you wouldn't feel anything. And it is one of the strangest feelings to occur as a man, as a human being, to not feel.
You mean you just functioned?
You just functioned. It felt as though, have you ever watched a film where you have the black lines at the top and the bottom?
Yeah.
That's how my life felt.
Right.
It felt as though I was looking at my life through a screen and there was a black line at the top and a black line at the bottom.
That you couldn't get.
And I couldn't get that black line moved.
Right.
And it didn't make any sense. And I just felt as though I was waking up, I was eating, I was staring at the world was staring back at me, and that was it. And because of that, I got off of my medication. I stopped taking it, and I looped again. As soon as I came off my medication, I went back through a massive bipolar episode, ended up like walking the streets. I went all the way down to my old house in Spikestown. I mean, that's just a whole nother long story.
Your behavior from what you've described, Matthew, was erratic. But what impact was it having on those closest to you, your wife and relatives?
Well, it became unsustainable, because imagine you have your son or your daughter in the house. They can't go to work because their mind isn't there. You have to go to work and you have to hope that when you get back, they're okay and they haven't done anything. That was what my mum, my sisters, my wife to be, at, because she wasn't my wife at the time, Joe, but she was we were together. That's what they were going through. Joe eventually, because it got so stressful for her, she flew back to England, right? But she was so concerned that she eventually came back to Barbados to help me. But for a period of time, she had to fly up to England because it was so, what I was saying, what I was doing, how I was thinking, it was just impacting everybody in a very visceral way, because not only am I going through a mental breakdown, but my sister, she has a daughter who has something known as hydrocephalus, which is water on the brain. So she is very mentally restricted. Best word to say. So she can't talk. She can't really speak. You have to guide her to the bathroom. And she's 15 years old. Mm. You know? So imagine my mum thinking of, you know, I have my daughter who has a child with a mental disability, and then my son has lost his mind. So it had the family completely turned upside down. My mum and my dad didn't live together, so there wasn't that cohesion. My dad was a bit more flippant about it, and that really wound my mum up. So it caused the family dynamic to become really, really dark and almost slightly, I wouldn't say hostile, but it got bad.
I'm sure even, you know, it must have been, as you've described, very testing. Where did you find recovery? If recovery is the right word, I don't know, stability.
I think the first thing would be stability. I needed to get stability. The stability came when I was put back into the institution, when I was institutionalized, that's the right word, the second time. Because I had another severe bipolar episode. My mum couldn't handle it. My dad said straight, just get him to the psychiatric hospital. I went and I stayed there for 5 weeks. And in those 5 weeks, for the first week, because when my mum came to visit me the first time and I was sat in the waiting area, I saw her and I ran towards her. And because I ran towards her, all of the doctors got concerned. So they snatched me and threw me into a cell. Right? So for the first week, I was in isolation. I've never been in isolation. And in isolation in these institutions, all I had was a mattress. A mattress. And do you know what a potty is?
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
So I had to use a mattress and use the bathroom and the potty. And I was in there for a week. And in that week, being isolated and recognizing that my life, which started off as being somebody who was singing, having gigs, and kind of going through life the way I wanted it to go, in a sense, you know, to falling all the way down due to my mental break, falling all the way down to being in a holding cell where I didn't get released at all for like three days. I was in there 24 hours. I had no release. So it was like solitary confinement, basically. Do you mind if I use an expletive?
Yeah.
I could smell my own shit and my own piss because, you know, they change it once a day, and I had to sit there in a mosquito-ridden cell peeing and shitting in a bowl. And when that reality hit me, even though I was looping, that reality cut through more than anything else. I don't know if you can have a strong mind when your mind is broken, but I had a stronger will to unbreak my mind at that moment. I said, Matthew, this is foolishness. There is no way you are going to end up staying in a hospital. You are going to get out of it here. I use that. And the problem is, sometimes that strong will can backfire, because it backfired earlier when I was taking medication and then I thought, and I came off of it because I was like, I don't want to be taking medication for the rest of my life. I do not want this to happen, because this is what they were telling me, you know, in the hospitals. They said, you could end up having to come here every day for the rest of your life to fill up on medication. And I was like, no, that can't happen. So, but that strong will can sometimes be a problem. So I had the will to not allow my brain to break me anymore. In this moment, while I was in solitary confinement, when I came out of solitary, I was a lot more relaxed. I was.
Were you back on the medication?
I was. You don't get off the medication,
right? Okay.
Right, because they will force you.
Right. Okay.
They will force you. If not, they will inject you, and there are injections that they have that when you get injected by this, you don't really come back.
Mm.
Barbados is one of these places where we are still trying to get a grasp as to how best to deal with mental health.
Okay.
So some of the procedures may still be a bit archaic, okay. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
But I was on the mend. I was on the meds. I made up in my mind, Matthew, you're going to have to get your head right. And from the time I got out of solitary, because it was only a week, I made it up in my mind, I'm not going to stay here for too long. And the thing is, you always want to get out. As long as you're in, you want to get out.
Mm.
And I'm sure you understand that feeling, right?
Mm.
As long as you're in, you want to get out.
How long did you spend in there?
5 weeks.
5 weeks. But by the time, let's talk about when you were released. By the time you were, I say released, or I don't know.
I was released into the care of my family.
Right. And at that point, were you more in control of your condition?
Yeah. At that point, I was a lot more stable, but I still had this sense of not being able to fully feel. And that was due to the medication.
Right.
So when I got out, my family took me in, and then my wife. I need to make this point. During my time, and this is the most important thing, and I think people need to understand this. During my time in, while I was being almost incarcerated in a sense, my wife flew back, and she flew back for 1 week, and she visited me every day, and every day I would tell her, you're a succubus. You know what's a succubus?
No, what's a succubus?
It's a demon. It's a really? Demon. I, you know, because I'm thinking she caused me to lose my mind. Because I met her and then I ended up losing my mind.
Right.
Not knowing that there's so many things that built up to that point.
Mm.
Right? But I kind of used her as an outlet of blame, which wasn't fair on her. But she, being the strong, sensible, beautiful woman that she is, recognized that that wasn't really where my mind was. She recognized that I wasn't in my senses. So I didn't understand what was going on.
Mm.
And she would come every day, visit me. The first few days, I was obviously distant. I was very blunt, wondering, why is she here? Why are you here? Da, da, da. But after a while, you know, just having somebody there and knowing that you can trust that person is there is so important to making your mind and getting your mind back on track. It's a bit like a foundation. Mm. It's like a mental foundation that if all else fails, I know that I can trust this person to keep my mind straight. So when I did come out, between my family, but mostly her, really helped to mold me back into the person I am now. But it wasn't easy for the first couple months. As soon as I came out, I cut all my hair off. I have locks again, right? But I cut all my hair off. My wife, Joe, she would carry me to the sea and I'd swim and swim. I put on a lot of weight while I was there, so I wanted to reduce the weight, so I started swimming again. One of the most important things is to keep active, to get yourself fit. Because when you are in a place like that where you feel nothing, you don't feel to do anything. You don't feel to want to do anything. You don't feel like anything makes sense doing. The whole world feels empty to you.
Is this part of the bipolar condition or
I am not sure. I am not sure. This is the thing. But this is why I want to speak so heavily on the actual experience itself. Because I think a lot of people don't really, they skim around the actual experience. They say, oh, how many people you would hear, oh, I might have a bit of an ADHD issue, or I might have I've been diagnosed as bipolar. And they kind of are flippant about it nowadays. For me, I think people need to understand how hard it is to operate when you break your mind, when your mind says and does things that you don't want it to do, but it's doing it and it's telling you that it's correct.
And it must be even more frightening. I say frightening because I can't think of another word to explain. It must be even more frightening when you're aware of it.
Yes.
It sounds like there were times
I was,
that you were
this is,
aware.
This is
like
why, yeah,
in
this
the
is,
isolation cell.
This is why I'm so, animated
right.
about talking about it and sticking to and kind of like describing it, because I was very aware that I knew my head was gone. I knew my mind was not there, but you can't stop it.
No control.
You have no control. So that's where the medication comes in. That's where the love and affection of a family and a wife comes in. That's where, and that's, I think all human beings have the capacity, if they want to take it, to make, if you have a second chance, you have the capacity to take it. You have to recognize that this is the second chance that you're getting. And I think you get second chances in all different scenarios, right? Because if you didn't, you'd be dead.
What have you done with your second chance? I mean, it sounds like, you know, you slowly started to recover, lost weight, grew your hair back, your locks back.
Got my locks back.
You're still with your
still
wife,
with my wife. She's my wife now,
right?
She was,
so that didn't break it.
That didn't break
it. Tested.
It was massively tested, and it's testament to her. And her ability to be, now she is an older woman, right? She's older than me, right? I'm what, 36 now, right? And she's nearly 20 years older than me, right? Full disclosure. And maybe her experience is also what helped, but she was the right person at the time for the scenario for me to get myself out of it. Because I'll tell you this. If it was just my family, I wouldn't be having this conversation with you. Or I would have been, but it would have been even harder.
I understand.
Because of the way in which the culture of Barbados is, and this is not an indictment on my country.
No,
I love my country.
I understand.
It's just how
well,
things
it could
are
have
done.
Been in Barbados, it could have been within the diaspora here in the
it
UK.
It could be here, exactly.
It's just sometimes these stigmas are still
these
not
stigmas,
I think
exactly.
More and more people are starting to recognise the issue of bipolar or other mental health issues, and we talk about it regularly. I mean, it's Mental Health Month this month.
Exactly.
As you and I talk, and it's something that people talk quite openly about. I spoke to someone who is a businessman who does suffer from bipolar, and he's made a whole, I wouldn't say business out of bipolar, but he's made a business out of making people recognize the ups and downs that you've talked about.
Yeah.
But let me ask you this, Matthew, as we move on. You obviously came out of that period and thanks to your wife, but also the support of your family, even though they, you know, it's really difficult, you know, and I understand that culture because half of my culture is Jamaican. So I understand
how
difficult it is for that culture. But how did it shape the person you are today? I mean, obviously recognizing that you have a condition that I'm sure you're still having to deal with in many different ways too.
In bits and bobs.
Okay. But what was you able to go on and do? Because you obviously left Barbados because you're here in the UK.
Yeah.
So you was able to sort of...
I was able to kick on, yeah. And I think that it comes with a recognition of understanding that you've been through something extremely traumatic and you've been given another opportunity. And you just grab it with both hands. And what I started to do after going through something like that was to just any opportunity that came, I said, you know what, I'll do it. I don't think that that's a, it's not a normal thing to have in Barbados, to have many opportunities. Mm. And again, a cultural thing. The small opportunities you have you ever had this idea, or have you, not an idea, have you ever met a person who wants to get somewhere in life? And you give them a small opportunity and they're like, man, I'm not really sure. You know, that's not really my thing. You know, it's a bit out of my, what I really want to do. What I really want to do is this, but you're pushing me down this road and it's similar, but you know, it's not exactly what I want. My thing is no. Stick me anywhere. If it has to do with music, if it has to do with, well, no, a podcast or talking about myself, just getting myself out there, I'll do it. Because what losing your mind has taught me is how precious your mind is, mm-hmm. and how precious and how beautiful it is to have a coherent thought, to have the ability to just speak. Sorry, I get a little emotional. It's weird.
Well, it's great that you do, because it's shows... weird.
I'm not thinking about it, right? I don't. Whoa, this was not supposed to happen.
And these are good emotions. You know, the fact that you talk so passionately, so powerfully, and I love what you just said there, that you're able to take that experience and articulate it the way that you have, in the way that you have, and the fact that it's evoked emotions that draw you back to those memories. But you have made a success. You have made a success of your life because you've overcome one of the biggest challenges that you face. And I'm not just talking about, you know, the trial and tribulations in terms of your mental breakdown, but the fact that you were able to still come out of that with the marriage, with the woman that stood by you, that you've been able to continue to do music. Because at the beginning of the podcast, we talked about the two beautiful songs that you created.
I haven't even spoken my story. The second one. But
But let me ask you this. What I want you to ask you, Matthew, is you've talked very eloquently about, you know, embracing your second chance and taking that second chance, you know, and turning it the way that you want, and that you're open to any opportunity because you relish the idea that you can now embark on these. What does the future hold for you? Well, and can I just, in that question, are you still having to deal with issues to do with your bipolar that sometimes hinders that?
I don't know if I've fixed it, because even though I think because of some of the medication I was on, and I think just how hard my mind went, I still find it difficult to articulate myself properly. I have racing thoughts, so that can have an issue where, like, just in this podcast alone, I'm talking to you about something, but there are like three and four different thoughts telling me, yeah, you could put this in, you could put this in. Oh, yeah,
that's
you remember
normal.
That.
That's normal. And people do that all the time.
People do that all the time. But when you have a situation where you haven't trusted your mind, where you had a period where you knew that your mind you couldn't trust, you always, there's anxiety is taking a TV, no, taking a camera in a studio, I'm pointing it to a television. Do you know what I mean by that?
No, I don't.
A camera in a studio is taking in the footage, right? So it's capturing the footage and it's showing it out to a television.
Right. Okay.
Imagine taking that captured footage and pointing it back at the television itself. It creates a loop.
Right.
It's similar to if you have a mic and you put it in front of a speaker. The mic is now taking in what the speaker is, and you get a you get a feedback. Anxiety is feedback. And that is what happens to my head when I am thinking of things.
How do you manage it then?
I don't know. I'll be
are
so
you still
honest.
On medication?
No,
you're
I'm
not. Medication, so you're managing it yourself.
I've managed it myself. I've made, and maybe this might be a bad thing, I will not prescribe this to anyone, right? But in the period of time, it took me about a year and a half to get off of the medication, but I made up in my mind that I was going to get off of it. So I started taking a certain amount, and then I tapered and I tapered on, I tapered off. And that's how I've been able to manage it. In terms of what life has in store for me, and the way in which I manage any episodes now, well, I've done a lot more with my music. I now have a website. 90% of my success I will absolutely grant to my wife, because she has helped push me. She's helped put me in scenarios for me to flourish. She's the type of person that, and I would love if you ever get a chance to meet her. She is like a manager of managers. She can just manage anything. And that's what I love about her. She can manage anything. And then she just says, Matthew, you go here. And I go there and I perform. Because now, since I've come to England, I do weddings, I do restaurants, all different types of gigs. I'm now doing a bit of a podcast talking about my mental health. I've been on another podcast before, a smaller one. I'm just doing to talk about artists and stuff like that and music. But all of these opportunities that I've had, like I would say about 80 to 90% of them have come through having a strong woman with me. And I think it is vitally important, especially when you're somebody who is going through mental health issues, that you have somebody who's there with you and who you can trust. And that's how I was able to get myself a lot more successful.
Do you know what's interesting and I admire the recognition that you've given to your fiance who became your wife, and still do. I do admire the recognition, but surely amongst that there's you. You for her to stay with you, it's not because she wants recognition, but there is obviously a strength in you. It's not just being good looking with dreadlocks. All I'm saying is that I hope you recognize the strength within your own character that has also kept her there, because she's been there for you. But no doubt in many ways you've been there for her as well, which is what's made your relationship, your marriage and your admiration for each other still be.
Can I be so honest with you? I'm not a person, and maybe this is my own fault that I have. I don't know my own strengths. I know my strengths in terms of music and in terms of singing and performing and being able to move people. But people describe certain things about me. Like my wife, she thinks that I'm such a professional and good person. And I'm like, I don't know why you think that. But how to put this? I want to put this the right way, just so that you understand. It's like I've never been a person who wanted to be arrogant. So because of that, I don't give myself a lot of praise. And maybe that's a good or a bad thing. I'm not sure.
For me, it's a good thing, because I think the lack of our self-recognition, it's all about how you portray yourself, what people see in you, not what you see in yourself. People have egos that interrupt
you.
But that's a good thing. So relish it, because it is great when other people
recognize. But it puts me in problems, because like there you would have like some people who have massive egos, who are easy to talk to, who, you know, they can, you know, just off their tongue, it's just so smooth. I'm not that.
I think you underestimate yourself.
But
that's a strength. I would argue that's a strength, Matthew. The fact that you don't recognize that is a strength, as well as it is for those who have those egos. No doubt they have their moments of darkness when they're
I've never capitalized on those things.
And you shouldn't, because I think it just comes naturally.
It just comes naturally.
And that puts you, I think, to some extent, it puts you in a better position when you're trying to play up to something.
I just feel awkward and I look awkward.
Can I just make this my last question and ask you if you are content and happy where you are today in your life, doing the things that you do? Now, obviously, I know you have ambition. Everybody should have some ambition, you know, to be I'd say, more successful in your music and in, you know, your life in general. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe you're very content with where you are with your music and your life in general. And you talk about your wife being the manager of your everyday existence. And it sounds like,
honestly.
But are you content and happy now, having been through such a trauma?
I'm really, really proud of myself. I mean, I talk up my wife a lot, right? And there's good reason, because I love my wife and I think she's phenomenal, right? Nothing's wrong with that. But in terms of looking at myself, and if I had to talk up myself a little bit, I'm really pleased with the ability that I had to not just recognize that I had a problem, accept that I had a problem, and work myself out of it. And be able to keep myself out of it. And to move on. And to have a successful life. And to have a story to talk about. An experience. A one-off experience that is unique to myself. You know, because anytime somebody has a mental breakdown, it's unique to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the mental breakdown, a lot of the times, reflects a lot of their inner issues and situations that have been going on in their life. So to go through something like that and to come out a stronger individual, stronger minded, stronger willed. I have music that I'll be releasing eventually.
Where can people listen to that?
It's not released as yet, but I do have a website called matthewallman.co.uk. That's where you get my bookings and if you want to find out more about who I am. But we will be building on that website a platform. Well, not, would you call it a platform? Yeah. In order for you to come and listen to my music.
Do you have an Instagram and Twitter?
I have an Instagram as well. It's Mr. Matt All. That's my Instagram handle. Singer Matthew Allman. That's how you have to put it in. Singer Matthew Allman. On Facebook, because there's so many different Matthew Allmans.
Okay, well, what we will do at the end of this podcast, we will put all the details. So anybody listening to this podcast, if they want to check out your music, and I intend to probably play a little bit of the song that you did about me
at
the
end
of the podcast. So keep listening, everybody. You can hear what Matthew did
for me. You do realize I'm wearing this shirt.
Pink
Floyd. Do you know why? We're talking about mental health, so you got Freud here. Freud, secondly, the song that I did for you, the second song was
I'd never heard it before.
Uncomfortably Numb. I'm really proud of what I did on that, because it describes a bit more about how I felt when I was going through my situation and how I thought you felt when you were going through your...
the question for me then is, how can we make that work? Because we have the audio. Mm-hmm. I can play a little bit at the end of this podcast for people to get a taste. But if they want to listen to the whole song, how can they? Because I don't know if there's a copyright issue around these songs, because they're both recognized songs.
I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I'm not really sure how... I think there may be a copyright issue, just simply because I'm using their instrumental track, but I've rewritten a lot of the words. But I do use the, instead of Comfortably Numb, I use Uncomfortably Numb. Yeah. I don't know if that's going to be an issue. Yeah.
Maybe I should.
I hope Pink Floyd and the guys wouldn't be too bound of shape.
I'm sure they wouldn't.
It's about mental health. It's a nice little tune.
Yeah.
You know, and if you have it available, I think you're also supposed to be doing some workshops.
Yeah.
Are you going to be doing things like that?
We will be. And, you know, we will put it to the best use we possibly can. But what I will do is link it so people can listen to it.
Because that would be great.
Would be very impressive.
That would be good. I will link it as well so people can give it a listen.
Is it on your website or anywhere? Because if I put the website details at the end of the episode, then people can click on that, go to your website, and then they could listen to the tracks.
The website has only been up for now, I think, probably a month.
Okay. But so there is some still, of your music on
so,
there.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there is. So you still can. You can go and you can check the website out. If you want to check out any more of my music, I will be putting it also on SoundCloud. So you can check it out there.
And have you got any gigs coming up? Any events coming up?
those you can find on my Facebook. They have a we have a list of the gigs. I'm also going to be in Barbados because this I'll be in Barbados over the holiday period, and I'll be doing performances there, and then I'll come back to England, and I will be back performing in Windsor. So if anybody's around in Windsor or Maidenhead area, they can come and check me out. You can find me on my Facebook, Singer Matthew Allman. That has all of the details as to where my performances are. But again, my in terms of my original music, that isn't fully established as yet, simply because, as you said, copyright issues and just building the website to make sure that it can house music, and because some websites allow it, some don't. So we have to get around that. But there you will be notified. Just follow me on Facebook or on Instagram. And when my music is out, you will definitely be notified. If you are more interested in it, if you hear it from a podcast with Raphael, you can just directly get in contact with me, and we can you can go from there, and I could make it more available to people.
Well, I encourage people to. Matthew, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you so much for
doing the songs that you did. I mean, it is a powerful story, but thank you for sharing your story. And I do encourage people to go to your website, listen to your music, and support you. And I wish you all the success in your career as a musician, man. Because you do have talent, as does many people. It's just the right person, the right opportunity to recognize, to give you that break that you want. Not that you're not already doing that. So thank you so much for sharing your
story. Thank you very much, Raphael, for having me. And I hope everybody enjoyed the story. Yeah, thank you so much. See you soon.
Unfortunately, due to copyright reasons, we can't play the soundtrack we talked about during the interview. But if you want to have a listen to Matthew's incredible voice, please visit his website. The details and links are in the show notes that accompany this episode. Matthew's ability to manage his bipolar condition without medication is a sign of real determination and awareness. Not allowing his mental health condition to stand in the way of his desire to keep on making music also shows how it is possible to live your life the ways you want to and not allow it to be completely dictated by a mental health condition. If anyone listening to this feels they need to check in on their mental health, please go to the show notes about this episode, and at the end of those notes, you will find a link to Mind, an organisation where you can find out more about the kinds of advice, support and help you can get for mental health problems. Please share this episode with your friends and family and colleagues, and follow the show for updates about new episodes by just clicking on subscribe. Your support really matters. You can also be a part of this podcast by rating and reviewing what you've heard, and tell us what you think. More importantly, tell others what you think by leaving some comments and feedback. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy Second Chance Podcast. Audio editing is by Audio Avalanche. The original music is by J-Row Productions. The cover design work is by Studio Minerva. Our social media creator is Sophie Warner. This episode was produced by Second Chance Podcast and me, your host, Raphael Rowe.